Before we get started with today's episode, I'm excited to tell you about the Fire Time magazine. Now, I'll tell you a little bit more about this partway through the episode, but for right now, you need to go to the website, itsfiretime.com/app, and download the smartphone app for the Fire Time magazine. I'll tell you a little bit more partway through today's episode. Welcome to the Fire Time podcast, where it's never hot enough, slow is fast, and the way to win is to make it so stupidly easy to buy from you that there's no excuse not to. I'm your host, Tim Reed. And once again, I'm so excited to be here today. Thank you for listening to the Fire Time podcast. Now, it's crazy to think that here we are in the thick of fall, the season is crazy, and season five is getting to the tail end. It's weird to think about. I feel like we were literally just starting this season out. Now, I'm excited about today's episode because today I'm interviewing Dick Hoffman. And for those of you that don't know him, Dick Hoffman is actually the chairman of the HPBA National Board, which is a big deal. And he's somebody that I've gotten to know a little bit through my time on the board, and I've really appreciated what he brings to the table. Because what's really cool about him is that he's actually retired. And as you'll hear in the conversation today, Dick owned a retail store for years and years and years and ended up successfully selling it to a new business owner and then volunteering a lot of his time towards the bigger picture of our industry through the HPBA board. And now as the chairman, he's able to serve at the national level. And because of the amount of time on his hands, he can dive into all kinds of projects and initiatives that a normal chairperson may not be able to because the demands and constraints on their time. So in today's conversation, you're going to hear about a lot of different aspects of owning a business. I try to ask Dick all about, like, what was the process like of getting the business ready? How long did it take to sell? When someone's looking to purchase a business, how do they value it? We also talk about kind of the big picture of the work that the HPBA board does and really what the responsibility of the chairperson is. And he gives some really good insight to that. We talk about this on the podcast from time to time, but I really want to just highlight in this to pay attention to the work that the HPBA is doing at the national level. For me, for years and years in the industry, I would just kind of tune out the updates at the yearly meetings and make the excuse that it didn't apply to me. But the truth is that our industry is in the middle of all kinds of battles, and the HPBA is keeping us focused and directed, and they're really working on protecting us so that we have an industry 10 years from now and 20 years from now. So it's really cool to have this conversation with Dick and hear about everything that he's doing to help fight this battle. But the fact that he comes from a retail background, he's not just, you know, some guy in a suit with no connection to our industry. He intimately knows what it's like to be working a crazy showroom on a Saturday in the busy season. And it's cool that someone with that experience right now is the chairman of our national board. So I'll get out of the way. At the end, I want to circle back and talk about a few things that he brings up in the episode. But for now, enjoy my conversation with Dick Hoffman. Joining me from Asheville, North Carolina, is the chairman of the HPBA board. I'm joined today by Dick Hoffman. Dick, how you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Thanks.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I'm excited to have you here. And I think this is going to be a really cool conversation. We've been talking a lot this season just about kind of the individual leader and what are the practices and things that they're putting in place to run a better business and serve their customers better. And I think that you're going to give us just a ton of value. But to start things out, I wanted to ask, can you just talk about like your history in the industry just with broad strokes? Because you've been in this for a while, right?
Yes, I have. Thanks. I was in a wholesale distribution career that ended up moving us to Charlotte, North Carolina. And after being in Charlotte and dealing with a corporate entity that was on the West Coast, I decided that it was really better that we move back to Asheville. So we looked for an opportunity and located an individual in Charlotte that was developing a franchise. So we started with that. And that was in 1994. We actually opened our business in 1995. My background had been in a number of areas in the wholesale industry. At that point in time, I was an executive responsible for a division and an officer of a corporation. So having number of things, it was a an opportunity to get into a retail business that was somewhat of a new area in the Asheville area. There had been some just pure hearth shops, but we came with a concept of hearth and patio and later included barbecue. So we started the business from scratch with the help of a framework from a franchise and functioned with that for a number of years and ultimately exited. We ended up changing our name to reflect a better image of what we did versus the original franchisor. And so we've grown our business over that period of time in 25 years. We made a change from a location midway through, bought our own building, warehousing, et cetera, and continued on until we got to a point a year or so ago where we exited from the retail side of it.
Wow. So I just want to go back here. Was the franchise that you were a part of at the beginning, was that in the hearth industry?
It was. That individual had started something in Charlotte that primarily was hearth, but had expanded into casual. So he was primarily hearth and a patio. When we opened in Asheville, obviously, we found that by location, climate, we had a much stronger hearth business. And that probably was the springboard for our successes, was primarily in hearth.
I mean, I'm just imagining if you start with a franchise model, though, there had to be some amazing systems and processes that came with that where you didn't totally have to reinvent the wheel. Is that right? Or did you kind of have to do that when you went more to hearth?
Well, there was a framework, I guess, in terms of some prospectus, how to deal with a number of things. He had published probably a framework for his franchise offerings. And we found that pretty helpful. Initially, he did do a lot of training, introduced us to a lot of industry representatives, companies, et cetera, kind of guided us in the things that he had found successful, which we actually just built on based on recognizing we had different kind of climates and different customer base in the Asheville area.
Mm. Now, why was it so important that you bought your own building?
I think in long term, retailers work really hard at what they do, and to accumulate some kind of an asset is important to that. When we started, we were doing a lease on a space, and we had a great location, but it was a pretty costly thing. And realizing that, you know, at the end of a period of your leases, you've enjoyed a great location, but you haven't created any asset value for long term. So for us, it was a recognizable thing to turn those lease payments into mortgage payments. And at some point in time, hopefully you've created something that becomes your 401k, so to speak.
Yeah, my father-in-law did that with their building. They were really fortunate with being at the right place at the right time. They took advantage of it, and the value of the building grew quite a bit, and he was able to use that for a lot of his retirement. It's really cool.
Similar to us, when we ended up exiting the retail side, we turned around and leased back the retail location. Did similarly with the warehouse, although we held the office space in a garage area that I keep for some personal things.
Okay. Yeah. So, Dick, that's really cool that you guys did that. And I know that now in your retirement, you've gotten way more involved with HPBA. I mean, I guess you had been before to some degree, but you're the chairman of the board now. And I think this is something that a lot of people listening haven't really thought about, or maybe don't know what the chairman of the board does. I know for me, I'm involved with the board now, but for years before that, I just figured HPBA did something, you know, and I knew that in some way they helped with government affairs and things like that. But now that I'm on the board and I've kind of seen some of the inner workings of it, there's a lot that the chairman does, and it seems like a really unique role. And I guess I say chairman, it's the chairperson, because it can obviously be a man or a woman. But can you talk about what you're doing specifically as the chairman of the board?
Sure. To key off of what you said, I've been involved in the affiliate level for a long time. And our affiliate board has functioned with the basis of those that want to be involved and use their expertise. So I've had an opportunity to stay involved on the affiliate level, and from a number of times participated with the board as an affiliate president or board rep. The opportunity came up to step into some kind of a role once on the board as the board rep. And I found that, like you, it's a completely different base of knowledge that you're exposed to when you're at the board level and even as a chair. So the chairman really is responsible for the direction of the board, and the board directs the staff. Jack Goldman, our president and CEO, does the functions of that with the board leadership. So the chairman is really there to conduct that role, to take any of those things from the board level for approvals and guidance back to Jack and to the staff. You know, the things that I have found has been an involvement in just attending meetings to be knowledgeable and participate where I can. Obviously, I attended a number of annual meetings that occurred, not as many as usual. And we've been able to involve a number of different directions. I instituted the president's roundtable discussions to try and get better communication. I work on a regular basis with Jack to keep in touch with and communicate, share ideas and direction. And one of the things that the chairman obviously tries to do is to move the needle in some direction with the industry as a whole.
So with you coming on as the chairperson, it's a 1-year term, right? Which isn't very long. And coming into it, did you try to think about, like, is there a pet project? Is there something that you're really trying to move the needle on this year?
Well, I have. And, you know, my background as a retailer probably is a little bit more than we had in the past with retail. The structure of the board is split between manufacturer representation and affiliate level, which is for the most part retail based. But we have a number of people, you know, in the affiliates that come from a distribution or representation. So even that's a little bit of a mix. So my focus was really to be a voice a little bit stronger for retail. So the things that I've looked at doing have been to support that. In the article with Richard Wright, I stated that I wanted to improve the image and the focus on the hearth side. Well, this year's been a little bit tough to do some of that, although we've rebounded in the industry and finding that we have a pretty good season going on. So the other things that I wanted to do was to look at ways to help do that on the retail level. So I focused on things. We've evolved a retailer toolkit on the HPBA website that addresses elements that can help retailers, information. Some of those things may have existed in different checkerboard square locations. So we've been able to pull that together in one location as a retailer toolkit. Ideas not necessarily new. Government affairs actually developed the toolkit for government affairs where people could be informed and get the information. But I felt like retailers needed the same kind of thing. So my focus, I guess you'd have to say in summary, has been to try and move the needle in the way of things that can support the retailer segment of our industry. And that's where really a product gets sold, product gets dealt with. So it's pretty important to support that side of our industry.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you there. And I'll link to that in the show notes. So for anybody listening that wants to get a hold of that toolkit, you can go to the show notes and I'll make sure to link to that. I want to pivot and ask you, Dick, how did you know it was time to get your business ready to sell? And I guess that's obviously going to be before you sold it. But when did you start thinking about maybe it's time to start getting this thing ready?
Well, I think, you know, for us, I'd had a previous career in another industry. And we realized that as we, you know, celebrated another anniversary, that maybe it was time to be thinking about that. We had weathered through a lot of different things over the course of time, the most recent having been 07 and 08. With that recession, which was really very difficult for us. And we had to make a lot of changes, sacrifice, reinvest in the business. And once we kind of got to the point, probably in 2015, we began to kind of jokingly say to each other, my wife and I, that, you know, we need to figure out what we're going to do when we grow up. But hey, this coming birthday, maybe it's time to be giving some thought to that. So we kind of kicked that around over a couple of years. So about 3 years ago, we really got to the point where we decided that, you know, from the standpoint of what we're doing, the business is successful. It is. The economy seems to be going good. Might be time to look at how we exit, maybe enjoy some of the things that we've invested in and take some of those opportunities, enjoy life a little bit. We worked pretty hard at it for a number of years. So that was how we kind of came to that point.
So what was involved in getting the business ready? We've talked with some folks this season and a little bit last season about kind of what it takes, like financially, to get your ducks in a row, to make sure that your books are right, to kind of walk through that process with a suitor that's looking at buying the business. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think, you know, from our background, both my wife and I had experiences, and we did an exceptionally good job with our business in terms of how we managed and financially kept our records. But I don't think we really understood that if you're thinking about your business and selling it or exiting, what do you need to do? What is your plan?
Yeah.
And I guess our story began with that conversation of, well, you know, let's quit talking about it. Let's do something about it. And so my wife really took the bit of the lead to look at where actually our franchisor had gone a number of years before. How did he exit? And he had used a brokerage firm. So she dug a little deeper and realized that the brokerage firm was based in the Carolinas, had offices throughout the Southeast, and one was in Asheville.
Okay.
And so we talked about that. I said, well, yeah, let's just call. Let's just make some kind of a connection and see where we are. We kind of put some numbers together on our own. So we had a preliminary meeting and talked through that. And with that, they outlined really what needs to happen. And I think this is important to anybody in business, whether it's a retailer, service industry, wholesale manufacturing. It's all dependent on your ability to show capable earnings. Anyone that's going to invest in a business wants to see a return. And that return obviously has got to satisfy their investment. So with that, all of those things relate to how you prepare being able to present that. Our experience with the broker was to lead us through looking at the P&Ls, identify any of those elements about our business that impact income back to the investor. You know, in small businesses, you try and take advantage of things that maybe your business can provide for and share in the cost or provide for totally. Well, those things are income that have to be identified that it's not totally on the P&L. It's a natural course of business. You've got inventories, you've got equipment, goodwill. So all of those things begin to come together. But again, it comes back to that ability for the investor to see that he can get a return on that income or money that he has put into a business for his income and satisfy his investment. So those things are important. So the word there going forward is make sure that you're operating your business with good records, some type of a software that provides you with a P&L that you can show your sales, all of those elements that come together to bring a bottom line in.
How often would you check a P&L or an income statement and things like that?
Well, I think that's important to do monthly, maybe not in depth every month, but that's a window on what's going on in your business. You know, some elements are more important to look at every month. Obviously, in our industry, you've got a seasonal roller coaster where some months are not great and some months are fantastic. But overall, you need to look at where you are with your expenses, look at your inventory, your investment, watch for trends, realize where you are maybe against some individual areas. Are you investing well in how you promote your business? How maybe in the case of your locale, is it time to be into a purchase? If you're not already into it.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to know too, when you sold the business, obviously the finances is a huge part of it, but the person coming in, I'm assuming that, did they have industry experience? I guess I'm assuming that they didn't, but how did that work out?
Well, I think, you know, for our experience, the broker side of it became also as important in going through our P&Ls and looking at, I think we used primarily a three-year window to show where we'd been each year. We had available, obviously, the previous years to look at, too. So with that, it it allows the broker, in our case, to look at how someone can truly afford a business. And for us, the brokerage firm actually had some financial institutions locally to go out just based on our performa and get sort of a pre-commitment to a borrower based on their credentials. So our business would support a loan based on what we had done by the broker taking it out and saying, here, I have a business for sale. Here's their performa. Here's the purchase price. Here's what we're looking at. Where do you see your institution in a loan? So he sort of pre-qualified our business. Then it was a matter of finding, you know, the right buyer and his credentials to line up.
Yeah. Wow, that's really good. And did you end up selling it to someone that had previous industry experience or someone that was not familiar with the industry?
Someone completely out of the industry. An individual that was in a completely different industry, had a early career, young family living in a metropolitan area, wanted to move to our locale, use their expertise in becoming an entrepreneur. So in his case, he had actually had interest previous year, same broker, same area, but had waited a little bit too long on a potential and lost in getting an offer in. So he's somewhat withdrawn to the sideline. So as we started working with this broker, he said, you know, I've got some potentials that I'll follow up on. In addition to what we do as a brokerage company to actually promote a business on a confidential level, and we'll go, you know, in our Southeast corridor, and we're participants in other venues so that it even becomes somewhat of a national base to have people that can see your business and look at it. And we'll do it all on a confidential basis. So this individual was one of those of about four different ones that we met with and looked at our business. And he became the person that really came to the forefront and said, yes, I want to do this. I've got my financing. Here's how I can approach that. And we just moved through the process.
Wow. So I guess the cool thing with that is that if you have a business that's ready to sell to someone from outside the industry, that must mean that to some degree, you'd primed your business to kind of be able to run without you, right? So this person could come in and kind of slowly learn, but the business is somewhat self-sustaining?
Somewhat.
Somewhat. Yeah. Talk to me about that.
I think, you know, in our category, we were very successful small business, but we did it with a few people. So in our case, always use the scenario, our hat rack's pretty big.
Okay.
So, and I think, you know, preparing for that, you have to have a good base of people in the business that can really sustain the business. But it also, in our case, needs to be understood that the business owner is not going to operate from a 50,000 foot level. He's got to be on the ground handling a number of things. And I think, you know, for the most case, our industry is made up of businesses like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, as you get larger, you develop more of a base and a system that you can easily step out. But I think in our case, that buyer now is realizing, you know, he's operating with pretty good hat rack. Not at the 50,000 foot level, but, you know, sea level.
We'll get back to our conversation with Dick Hoffman in just 1 minute. Hey, I teased this out at the beginning of the episode, but for those of you that haven't yet, you have got to check out the Fire Time magazine. Now, I'll just lay my cards on the table. This is something that me and Grant had talked about for a while. And we were on the fence as to whether now was the time to drop this or not. But in the event of Hearth and Home shutting their doors back in September, we felt like there was such a void in the industry for communication and knowledge and information to go out that now was the time to release this. And so with that, we have available for you today the Fire Time magazine. And this is something that can be consumed in a couple of different ways. First off, is you can download a smartphone or tablet app, and every issue is going to be sent straight to your device. You can get that by going to the website itsfiretime.com/app. But you can also sign up to get this delivered in your inbox if you want to view it through your web browser instead of an app. And the way that you can do that is you can go to the website, itsfiretime.com/subscribe, and you can enter your email address and everything will be delivered to you. Now, the way that we decided to roll this out is we first off built a prototype issue, and that's available right now with real articles and interviews and tips and insight to help you grow your business. But our official release is going to be in March of 2021. So between now and March, we're assembling our content, we're putting together all of our contributors, and we're gearing up to start launching this every single month beginning in March of 2021. So to take advantage of our prototype issue right now, you can go to thefiretimemagazine.com and follow the appropriate link. We cannot wait to see where this magazine goes and are so excited to see leaders like you grow your business through the content that's inside of it. So to check out this free resource, you can go to the website, thefiretimemagazine.com.
How long did the process take from when you first decided you wanted to sell to actually completing the deal?
We ended up start to finish probably in an 8-month period, which I think is somewhat exceptional. When we started, you know, it was let's put a toe in the water and see how things might come to a sale. As I elaborated, we made contact. We went through those process of analysts looking at the financials, establishing what they felt like was a sales price. And, you know, incidentally, I was asked the question in that interview of, what's your number? So I gave a number and I said, you know, this is a number that I use that somewhat came from another industry, and it's based on a number of multiple factors. And so we went through that and he said, well, I have good news for you. I think we actually can support a higher number based on how we look at a business and how we value it. So from that case, we began to be probably about 3 months into it when the first, I guess, public offering was released in, you know, their site and their force to go out and sell it. Within pretty short order, I guess, in about a 3-month period, we'd gone through multiple visits and our buyer became the lead, and we got into negotiation. And price-wise, we didn't move too much off of the price at all. I think our brokerage firm was realistic in what they put together, and he had been able to take their same numbers and our prospectus to his lenders and secure a loan. And so that process really is where, you know, it kind of took off. But at that point, we're committed, and then it just slows down because you're dealing with other entities that have their process, and you know, got to be a number of things that support their decision, not just what you've given them. They've got to do their own analysis. So we ended up with a firm offer and agreement probably during the month of September, and our buyer hit a little bit of a snag with a previous loan commitment that he felt like was the best. But I think when it came down to it, they sort of changed the game plan when they got ready to say, yes, we're going to do it. However, we're going to need you to do this, and we can't do that, and you're going to have to do this. And those weren't things that he really expected. So he went to his secondary loan, and again, we're back into a process. So that took a while, but that went through easily enough. And we got a closing date, and we closed in November. So counting start to finish, we were about 8 months. And I have to say, when we started, we met our first interview, we felt like it was probably a multi-year situation where this is not going to happen, even though at that point in time, we were in a pretty good economy and things looked pretty good. So I think we're kind of the exception, but it supports my comments about have your business ready. You know, there are things that you need to do from the financial side, but you also have things you need to do, you know, on the physical side with your showroom, your storage, warehouse, if you're in a warehouse situation. At some point, people are going to want to look at that and understand, what do these things do to support these financials? Is it as good as it looks? So I'd have to say that we had a little bit of catch up to do as we got into that interview process to say, you know, we need to work on, you know, just going through and look at maybe some inventory things that ought to be cleared. They're on the books, but, you know, it's probably better for somebody coming into the business not to deal with those. You know, maybe some cleanup that you get a little blind to in a smaller business, you know, realize that maybe it doesn't look as fresh as someone from the outside coming in to see it. So 8 months, great story, but probably a little bit of the exception.
Oh, no, that's a great story. I think that's going to give a bunch of value to people who are listening. I just want to ask you one more question about it and then move on. But you talked about how you had your criteria for kind of how you put the numbers together of what you thought the valuation was. What was the criteria that that your brokerage company used to try to determine a value?
Going back to it, it's really the financials. You know, if somebody has X thousand dollars to put into a business, they want to see it have return and satisfy their needs. If they're going to be active in the business, which I think in our case, most small businesses are going to be that way. There's a salary.
Yeah.
And then there's the overhead of what indebtedness you've taken on in the mortgage you've got to cover too. At some point, where are you going to pay that out? And now your investment is really secure and it's providing you the return long-term you're looking at.
Yeah.
Initially, you know, my calculations were, I said it before, but heavily weighted on the value of inventory, FF&E or furniture, fixtures, equipment, et cetera. And, you know, its ability to show a profit. And that inventory is a fixed solid thing, but that's not necessarily the value that someone's buying. They want to be able to buy something that returns to them dollars. And if inventory is good, that's going to be a part of it. You know, that's a physical thing that's going to help, but it's still got to turn dollars back. And that's what they're looking for.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really good. I think it's so valuable to have these conversations as more and more businesses are just getting to that point of thinking about this. And I think it's cool that you're here to share that. Now that you're retired, though, I mean, you're still involved in the industry, which is funny. I mean, a lot of people want to, you know, I mean, they just want to go have fun and they want to be done. What do you love about this industry so much that makes you still want to have this level of involvement in your retirement?
You know, that's kind of an easy and a hard question. Haven't been involved in the industry for long term, you know, I just have a compassion for it. It provided for a lot of positive things, a lot of heartaches. But I think overall, the connection with the industry is company, people, the things that it provides you for. And having been, you know, at retail for those number of years, been involved on the affiliate level, and then had an opportunity to be a part of the big board, I just want to see if I can make a difference in some fashion to make sure that it continues on an even keel, if not find things that help improve it.
Yeah, that's really good. Who's on your Mount Rushmore for the fireplace industry?
I got to give you an anecdotal story. You know, you had kind of previewed me on a couple of things. And so I'd given some thought to that. And my wife and I were chatting and she said, well, you know, are you ready for Tim's podcast? And I said, yeah, I think so. And she asked that question. And I jumped right into a name and she said, well, that's great, but Mount Rushmore's got multiple people. And I went, uh-oh.
Yeah, there's four of them.
I kind of, you know, missed that cue. So, you know, I gave thought to having four individual people. And again, part of the story is that she says to me, says, you know, your interest in what you do for the industry has been focused on retail. Maybe that's not a face, but maybe that ought to be one of them, is the retailer segment. So to Glenn's credit, I think she was right. That's probably one of the things that inspires me. It's kind of Mount Rushmore is, you know, the retailer who makes it all happen. They're the ones that are out there making the decisions to invest their money, purchase product, support it, become educated, get certified, those things. So, you know, I think let's start with saying the retail entity in an image that's to be determined maybe is the first one. I think the second one for me, and that was my first, was Tom Pugh. You know, I joined the industry at a time and had some contact with Tom Pugh, but the things that he was doing in writing, things that he was doing to be involved in the industry, I think live today. That Government Affairs Academy was one of those things that is an ongoing element that's important to our industry. So Tom Pugh's one of those guys. I think Richard Wright's another one for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're disappointed that Richard's come to that point where he's decided to retire. But Richard, in his time, you know, has been such a supporter of the industry for information, best awards. I think he's a great Mount Rushmore guy. And I think Rick Blahos is another one.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Rick stepped in behind Ben Weathersby in NFI and has brought it to a completely different level. And he continues to work hard. He's got, you know, such a level of enthusiasm. The things that he's doing and the people that are part of, you know, his staff are continuing to bring it to another level. So, you know, with that, who's the last one? And that's a little bit challenging. I thought about a number of past chairmen, and there were two that come to mind. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, which one is your favorite child?
Yeah.
So, you know, I have to say that probably Steve Hall, who was a past chairman back during the 07 and 08 period, where the industry was faced with a lot of different things and the organization itself. Jack and I talked about that with our year that's got some challenges of things that he and Steve had to work through to support the industry and get it through it. So Steve Hall becomes my last Mount Rushmore guy.
That's awesome. That's a great Mount Rushmore. I'm thinking about, I mean, yeah, Tom Pugh is just, he's a legend in the industry. We've talked about him extensively on the podcast before. The work that he did, you know, 20 years ago, we're still feeling the weight of and the fruit of. It's unbelievable. And obviously the work that Rick does with NFI, you know, a lot of it goes behind the scenes, but I'm convinced that as we get further and further down the road, NFI is only going to become more and more important as regulation comes in to require certification to install these things. It's amazing that we have a certification program that is specific and correct for our industry.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, you're right on track. You know, there's an area that our affiliate level is working on in their geographies to try and push that or respond to it.
Yeah.
I think that's an important message for people in the industry is to get your certification.
Absolutely.
That's going to be a key factor in the future.
Yeah, I mean, and you just think even from a sales and a marketing perspective, you know, at the retail level, if I'm on a showroom floor and I've got NFI certified installers, and I know my competition doesn't because I can check the internet to see who's approved and who's certified and
right.
Who's not, and I can look a customer in the face and say, I know our installations are a little bit more expensive, but our crews are certified to install these fireplaces, and our competition holds no certification for expertise on putting this in. You know, like we forget we're putting fire in people's houses. It makes sense to be certified
Absolutely.
To some degree. I mean, it's like it's crazy. But for you, like if you're in a market where not many people are NFI certified, like this is a sales and marketing advantage, and is in the customer's best interest to have certified people doing this work.
Oh, absolutely! It's a national certification. And interestingly, you know, having exited the retail side, I stay active in a number of ways. And one of those things, I come up on the NFI certification as a master hearth professional. And from time to time, I'll get a random call from somebody that's gone on that site and recognized that certification and call me about a question.
Wow.
That maybe could have been dealt with at a retail level or another certified person. But I think my MHP certification has kind of brought me to a level where they've recognized and called me about, I've got an issue and I'm not sure how to deal with this. And sometimes they hold back with telling you they've already started with maybe a non-certified.
Sure, yeah.
And something about it didn't sound right, didn't click that maybe that was the right thing to do. So that's been kind of an interesting thing to support that NFI certification, even, you know, at my level where I'm not active at retail.
Yeah, that's great. So, Dick, when it's all said and done, what do you want to be known for in this industry?
Well, we kind of kicked out around some things. I think, you know, for me, it's having been known for getting our industry through this period at the level that I could participate with the board and with the staff. And I think they've done a great job in doing that. Our industry staff has just maintained a level where nothing could be said that we've had a takeaway. So to have supported Jack and our staff, conducted our board meetings. We implemented first ever virtual, which is becoming the next normal. And I think we'll see more of that. Makes sense. But to maintain a status quo, getting us through that and then accomplish some of these things where we've implemented things that are beneficial to our members, albeit they may be on the retail level. Also to have been supportive of efforts with things that we've done on a legislative basis. I've had an opportunity to really be more involved and understand some of those issues, know some of the background. I had an opportunity to participate in an EPA virtual hearing, something I probably wouldn't have done. But again, I helped to contribute to the stability and maybe the future of our industry. So I'd like to be known for those kind of things.
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, it's awesome to hear. Like, I think your story is just so holistic, you know, coming from a different industry, starting from scratch with a retail business, working it all the way through to the point where it culminates in you selling it. And then now in your retirement, you take that experience and you use it to help the board. Dick, we appreciate your service. And I think people are going to get a ton of value out of this.
Well, thank you. You know, again, that kind of fits what I just said. I'd like to be known for having done something to help maintain our industry and make it better.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, we appreciate you being on and we'll see you later.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you, Tim.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with Dick Hoffman. I thought it was awesome getting the chance to talk to him. Now, rounding out, there's a couple of resources, first of all, that I want to make you aware of. Number one is he referenced the HPBA Retailers Toolkit, and there's going to be a link in the show notes, but you can go to the website hpba.org/retailer-toolkit to take advantage of all kinds of things there. Another thing is that the year before Dick became chairman, Joe Burns of Bernard Dawson Manufacturing was the chairman of the HPBA board. And one of his big pushes was to try to find a way to help retailers transition to the next generation. And so through some work that he was a part of, HPBA actually has a group that they work with that's called Sunbelt Business Brokers that can help your business get ready to be sold and facilitate that transaction. Again, there will be a link for their services in the show notes. Their website is sunbeltnetwork.com. But these are important things that HPBA's board is working on at the national level to try and find resources to help businesses with the problems that they're up against. And so I want to make sure that everybody listening has those websites available. Now, listening to Dick, it's obvious that he loves this industry. And one of the things that I thought was really cool is it's interesting to riff on this for a minute here at the end. One of the focuses that we have talked about a lot in this podcast is building a business that is bigger than yourself. And through using systems and processes and metrics, being able to get yourself above the fray as a business owner so that you can work on steering the business rather than being run over by it. Now, Dick made an important distinction when we started talking about systems and processes and getting the business ready to sell. And that's the fact that there are a lot of business owners that want to be in the trenches, that want to go to work every single day and be working to help people with doing installations, with making sales. And I think that that's a really important distinction to talk about, is that there is so much value in being a craftsperson that is excellent at what they do, whether that's installing, whether that's selling, whether that's running a company, whatever it is. And it's important to realize that a business dream is not a one-size-fits-all, and that when me and Grant have talked about trying to build systems and processes inside of a business, one thing that I want to make sure is real clear is that it's never going to get to a point where you don't have problems to solve. But what we want to do is put systems and processes in place so that the problems you solve are actually like fun and interesting problems, as opposed to the same old thing over and over and over again. And so whether you're somebody at a huge company that has like multiple team members or departments underneath you, or whether you purposely so work for a company that's much smaller where you're physically doing the work, I think what's amazing is that thinking about your business holistically will still allow you to put things in place to be the best version of that business possible. And one of the cool things with doing this is it actually gets your business ready to sell. I talked to someone from the Pacific Northwest a little while ago, and they were working on a situation on a business that due to a sudden health issue was forced to sell. But because they hadn't gotten their business ready to, they are in a really bad situation where they're getting taken advantage of and the business doesn't have a lot of value. And you know, everybody thinks that we're going to be healthy for years and years and years, but the truth is we have no idea what tomorrow holds. And it's really important to be laying these building blocks now before you think you need them. I think that that's one thing that's real apparent in this conversation is that Dick was really about preparing for the long term, and he did a really, really good job with it. And now he's been able to share in the benefit, and the business owner that has purchased his business is able to share in the benefit of the work that he did. So It's never too early to start thinking about getting your business ready. But obviously that can't happen if you as a leader aren't in a position where you're able to manage your business, where you're able to lead yourself and think about the bigger picture. So as has been the theme for this entire season, my hope after today is that you take some stock of your own life and you think about, where are the areas that I need to start preparing? Honestly, I think it starts personally and it moves out professionally from there. Where are the areas that I have to start laying groundwork now that's slow and boring and not sexy, no one recognizes it, but is going to be the thing that pays off down the road? I think it's just like becoming a runner, right? You know, your first time running, it's horrible to run like a mile or 2 miles. And the truth is that as you get to be a better and better runner and you run more and more miles, well, it's still really tiring. That never changes. But the distance that you run does, and the speed at which you run does. And there's no magic formula to doing this. There's just simply the day in and day out action of running every single day. That's the difference between a professional and an amateur. An amateur gives up when things are difficult, and a professional grinds it out and knows that the slow, painful work now is worth the payoff in the end. Well, I hope you guys got a ton of value out of that conversation. If this podcast has been a blessing for you, you can support it financially by going to the website patreon.com/itsfiretime. That's patreon.com/itsfiretime. We are so thankful for every single one of you that is helping support this through your monthly contributions. It means the world, and we don't take it lightly that we have a responsibility to provide you the highest quality content possible. So I hope you guys have an amazing week. As always, we will be back next week with even more. Thank you for listening to the Fire Time Podcast. To learn more, visit the website itsfiretime.com. The music from this episode was written and recorded by In Bloom out of Portland, Oregon. We thank you for listening to the Fire Time Podcast, where it's never hot enough, slow is fast, and the way to win is to make it so stupidly easy to buy from you that there's no excuse not to. We'll see you next time. I'm all in to burn.